Hi, this is Paul. Welcome to the Things I Didn't Learn in School podcast. For those of you that are newer to these conversations, the podcasts are one of three things that Still Press puts out. There's also a weekly essay that comes out on Substack. You can sign up for either the free or the paid versions on my website, paulpodolsky.com. And there's also a book, Raising a Thief, and another one, Master Minion. And if you enjoy these conversations, I think that you will enjoy the books and the essays as well. And so with that, thanks for listening, and let's get into our conversation. My guest today is Faye Keegan, who I worked with years ago, and is a brilliant woman, and the co-founder of Dipsy. Evidently, 50 million people out of 8 billion know who you are, but the rest of them don't. Give the audience a sense of where you grew up, mom and dad. I know you got a bunch of siblings and your journey.
I grew up, you know, in Connecticut, which is where also I met you, Paul, working in Westport, Connecticut at Bridgewater. I mean, mom and dad worked in finance, and I really thought I wanted to work in finance. And I did, obviously, for a while as well. I went to Dartmouth. I was econ. I feel like I entered a bank, like I did all that stuff. I interned at Bridgewater, infamous hedge fund based in Connecticut, where you and I met, and worked there for years out of college, for 3 years. Felt like longer, could have been a lifetime. Definitely got a lot of reps in before leaving, I guess, that career entirely and sort of reshaping myself in a totally new way, and starting eventually Dipsy. I guess the short version is, you know, we create short, sexy audio stories designed to turn women on, which is a little bit different than figuring out the impact of the shale boom on the US dollar, which is what I used to do. I mean, ultimately why we started, I can talk about that, is like, you know, I was at Bridgewater. I felt like I was unhappy, I guess, is the short version. But I also felt like the longer I was there, the less options I had on what to do next. Mm-hmm. Obviously, like there's kind of the practical sort of like non-compete legal reasons. But I think also I was like narrowing myself further and further down into a career, which I was becoming more and more certain wasn't the right career for me. I think when it comes down to markets, you have to, you know, be good at them. Like I was good at Bridgewater. I was good at my job. You can tell me if that's not true, but I think I was pretty good.
You're great.
Thank you. But you have to actually, I think, be personally passionate about that. And like ultimately I felt like the further I was down that path, I was just like doing something I thought I wanted to do versus wanted to do. And how could I sort of unblock my life a little bit and create more options for myself? So I sort of stumbled into software engineering, which is kind of like my ticket to that breadth that I wanted in terms of paths in my life. The CEO, whose team I was on, felt really strongly that software was going to be a big edge for Bridgewater going forward. And I ended up kind of being just sort of fortuitously the like investor person on a lot of that software development process and just really liking that part of my job more than the other parts of my job. And also feeling like more than that, software engineering was a way for me to like go do anything I want to do next. Like if I could be a software engineer, I could, you know, start my own company, which I ended up doing, or I work at a nonprofit. I could work in health tech. I could work in finance again, that there was this skill set that was going to allow me to do like whatever I wanted to do next, whatever that could be. And I felt itchy just to have, I think, more options and just to change my life up a little bit or a lot of it. And so I left Bridgewater, moved to San Francisco. I went to a coding boot camp. I became a software engineer. I spent 2 years after that at a fintech startup in San Francisco as a software engineer, learned how to like actually, you know, write code in production and build product. And I saw a company go from seed to series A, which company does not exist anymore. But I was like, dang, this fucking guy can do it. Why can't I? Which is good. I think that's like also a big learning from also Bridgewater to an extent is like, you're kind of like shoulder to shoulder with these like big deal people. And of course they're impressive and they're doing something that like, I didn't build a $1 billion hedge fund, of course, but it's just a person just like you.
That's right.
And so you might as well go for it. And if you don't go for it, you certainly can't achieve it. So I think blustered by a good amount of, new skills, some interest, a little bit of hubris, and a little bit of boredom. I wanted to start a company. I was itching to do so. And I started getting obsessed with the idea that is now Dipsy, along with my friend out here.
Dipsy itself is a fascinating story, and I want to spend most of the time talking about that. But it's also, there's like a really interesting kernel here of sort of, I think there's a big deal in life of the moment when you realize that you just grew up in a certain set of circumstances, and those don't need to be your circumstances. And that's a big difference, I think, between people who make really significant impact and changes and people who don't for all sorts of reasons. And it sounds like when did the first idea of Dipsy first percolate? And when were you beginning to think like, wait a minute, my mom and dad are in finance. Greenwich, where you grew up, is sort of the finance center of the world. Just because everybody's doing this doesn't mean, first of all, very few people in the world do it. So you grew up in a kind of odd kernel. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting thing when you begin to get perspective on that and go like, well, wait a minute, that's not actually who I am. And the whole kernel of a creative idea that becomes something is also fascinating.
At Bridgewater, and like there's tons of small things I think that have to happen too for you to quit, like big things and small things for you to like leave a job like that. And there's so much great things about that job. I remember because I'm the smartest people on earth. I made really good money. I live near all my friends. Like, I just think that was like cool and prestigious. Like, that is not nothing. And it was cool. Like, definitely in the bubble I'm in.
A lot of people give their right arm for that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's tons of reasons like not to leave a job like that. I'm sure I heard those too, but like ultimately like you're fucking in charge of your own life. It's got one life to live. Like, you can't be miserable. You can't go to work and complain about it. Like, don't go to work and complain about it. Like, you're choosing to do that. There's like parts of your life you can't control. And I had so much control. And ultimately having a job like Bridgewater, where also I did make money for 3 years, that can be a trap or it can be like a gift. It can be like the freedom to make a big bet on yourself and take a risk and choose other things for a short period of time, at least.
Was there any particular like story or moment, you know, you're sitting in a room and then the image comes like, whoa, this is not for me. Or was it a very slow thing?
There are many moments. I think in terms of the work product, like working in markets, I remember sitting around with my friends at Bridgewater, who I'm still good friends with today. And they were like talking about like the trades they had on. And like, I had no trades on. You know what I mean? Like, I could like go like toe to toe with anyone and like in class, at work, I did good research. Like, I just didn't. And I couldn't fake that. Like, I couldn't put trades on just to pretend that I just didn't really care. I think there's parts of that I miss now. Now I'm like, maybe I should have gotten more into it. I think it's like really exciting about, you know, winning and losing and volatility. And I still like to follow that stuff like a little bit on the side more than maybe average person. But if you're going to be good at that, if you're going to have alpha in markets, like you got to not be like kind of interested. I think you got to be like really interested. So I think just so many reps of that, I was like, this isn't like some class I'm taking that I'm acing. And that's how I was interacting with that role at Bridgewater. I was like, we had a class. Like I was good in the class. Like I was good at my job. Like I performed well and got good grades and whatever. But it's like that's only going to go so far. And then, you know, I'm 10 years into career at Bridgewater and I live in Westport. It's like, I don't actually care about, I'm never going to be the best.
When did the Dipsy thing start to percolate?
Yes. So it's like truly my friend, Gina and I, my co-founder and friend, started talking about it like in the way that people talk about things that don't become companies, like over wine, like in the middle of the week, like as 25-year-olds, as 26-year-olds. And really this idea that like, why wasn't there sexy content out there for us? And there was this really big gap, we felt like, in the market between like mainstream visual pornography, which is basically by and for men almost exclusively, and romance, which I think is actually a very inspiring sort of section, but kind of like outdated motifs, outdated format, like not really like hitting for, you know, at least our group.
Now, as a writer, I can say, like, if you want to sell books, it's either have a CIA guy against the world or have a woman falling in love with a guy on a horse coming down the hill.
Well, I think that's right, which is like ultimately we were like, okay, there's this gap that we feel like we're really inspired by companies like Calm and Headspace. They were doing audio really well. They were taking this niche thing like meditation and making it mainstream and also making content that was really effective at shifting like mood and moment. Like, I can't sleep, now I can. How can we kind of apply that use case to like a different use case? Like, I'm not turned on, now I am. But also we did a lot of research on the psychology of sex and desire. We like read everything we could and helped try to like productize that research. But the thing that ultimately, Paul, I think you'll also connect with this. The thing that ultimately went from like, helped me to take the leap from like, this is a cool thing to talk about. And like, wouldn't it be cool if and we could do this with the product? I think that I was like, no, we actually can start this company is the size of the romance industry today. Like romance is by far the highest selling genre of literature.
Totally.
It's like over $1 billion in book sales a year. And like book sales is just one element of what I call like broader romance media. Like Bridgerton season one and season two were the number one English language premieres on Netflix.
Totally.
Those are based on romance novel, yes. Bridgerton. Like romance is all the media you consume. Like romance is by far the highest selling genre literature. It is like where the money is made in books, all the top readers, all the top earning authors like in romance. And women consume romance over the course of their entire lives, often via subscriptions, a voracious appetite for that kind of content. And so actually it was like those market questions, which like were like, oh, I could, this actually could be a company.
There's a lot of theories of story. And one of the key reasons is it's sort of like species survival. They're teaching you different things. Like, so like there's a whole series of stories about escape. And think about what you did. Like you were in one track and you went to another. Now the story could be the guy is in a safe, you know, locked inside of a safe that gets thrown over a boat and he has to escape, but it's still escape. It's like telling that story. And there's periods of your life where you need to escape.
Right.
And the thing about the woman's romance is, you know, part of our mission in life, people might disagree with this, I think this is true, is to reproduce. And it's certainly been a central thing in my life. Like the thing of having children, raising them, it's like it was a central focus. And so the romance things always strike me as like, this is a huge fucking deal. And it's a huge fucking deal to everybody. But I, you know, it's a deal in a particular way to women that's different than men. We could talk about that for 5 hours. And so the stories are a little, I always thought it's a little bit about that. But your stuff is a little bit different. And so in some sort of cosmic sense, what is the role? Why do we keep telling them? Why do we need to retell them?
I would probably reframe the need to reproduce as like just generally humans wanting like some kind of an immortality project, right? And that could be your family or it could be like your legacy or whatever. And like, I don't know. Right now, Dipsy's my immortality project, but maybe I'll have another
like
one
fear
later.
Of death,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, yeah. Like a legacy solution. But I do think... romance, I think, is just one of connection, relationship, conflict, intimacy, sex. Like, these are human things. Like, I think one of the deeply human, like the most human thing, along with like sleeping and eating, like wanting those things. And one of the things that I think consistently surprises me about what we do is having people describe our product as niche. It's like, let me tell you, it's not niche. Like it's not
right. No, it's essential. Right. It's fundamental.
Exactly. Like, you know what's it's versus like meditation, like that's niche. Like that is a specific like that is who cares? Like truly. Like maybe I'm probably a big meditator, but like you know how many
that's a clip for social media.
You know how many people have people like masturbate than meditate? Billion, jillion more. Like there's not even a comparable the percentage is like 100% versus 2. Like I'm sure. 2 is like a generous estimation of how people meditate, right? And so if you're building, like, again, the romance thing also helps, obviously, in terms of, like, the actual dollar spent. People could just, like, not want to spend money on it, right? I felt, like, very confident from the beginning that the desire for this product was, could truly be any woman, every woman.
Yeah.
I think what's the kind of, like, wrinkle on that is that when it comes to media, when it comes to stories, but particularly when it comes to erotic storytelling, preferences are pretty specific and differentiated.
Yeah.
And so while like maybe in theory, right, like Dipsy's for everyone, we offer, you know, you start chopping that quickly down when you start to picking what stories you're going to tell. So like you're only doing English language. Okay. That's already like a lot of people work with. And then you're only doing a female POV, right? We basically just do that. There's like already like a less population. Okay, then we're doing like straight stories and queer stories. But then that maybe it's like Irish accent or enemies to lovers or like there's kink, there's no kink, whatever. You know what I mean? And it's all of a sudden like what people want is actually pretty specific. It's like a long tail of interest, not like an average of people's interests, which is why you see this in romance or whatever too. Like the market's really, really big, but markets that seem small are also really big, but it's lots of really, really fragmented markets that are being bucketed together like in romance. And that is like a big challenge when you're a small company, right? Is trying to like figuring out what audiences are big enough to serve and who you can serve adequately.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Story, erotica, women, just talk about that a little bit. I had this experience. I wrote two books. The first book was about being a parent, and the second book was the thrill genre. And the parent thing, I got invited to all these book clubs. I'm not kidding you. 99% of them were women.
I don't believe that men read books. Like, show me a man who reads books.
There was one book club I went to, and it was interesting that they asked me, the one thing they asked me about was like very specific interrogation was like none of the women even asked about that at all. It was about a sex scene that was in it. And they were like, were you complete? You know, it was like, I was like, I can't believe how differently men and women think about this type of thing. And women, because it was a story about, the story is basically about a really difficult parenting experience that women wanted to talk about a ton. The thriller thing, people are buying the book, but no book club. Because and I couldn't believe how genres, how gender specific stories were. It was like a revelation for me. I was like, holy shit. And by the way, we would read way more books than men. So I was like, okay, if I'm, for my third book, for fuck's sake, I am going to have a lot of stuff here that is thinking, because if you want to write, you're writing for women. You're not really writing for men.
I mean, it's a little bit of a hyperbolic statement, but like,
it's a little bit, but like, there's some truth to it.
It gets to the truth of the actual market for books.
Why are women in stories such a powerful thing? What's your insight on that?
Oh man, that's a really good question. I mean, the reality is indisputable, but I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure of the why. I think for when it comes to the context of erotica, I can definitely talk about it more specifically, what psychological research says about that. What does it say? So women... This is kind of like you might see on like every, Cosmo article ever, like women are less visual than men. Okay, that's like obvious. What that actually means though, when it comes down to, is that like men are more likely to like open up, Pornhub or whatever and search like specific body parts.
Interesting.
Right? Like big nipples or whatever. Please don't put that on your TikTok, me saying big nipples. But like, they're looking for like specific anatomical things that they want to see.
How interesting.
Much more likely to do that than women. Women are likely to type in like things like contexts, situations, relationships. Women are less likely to want to see Leonardo DiCaprio naked and more likely to want to know what he had for breakfast. Like there's a lot of what women are interested in, and the why might be like deeply biological or certainly societal. I think both those things are hard to actually pull apart. Like are interested in not just like the physical experience of sex, but the context surrounding it. Like they're much more care about status of the person there. Like that's what makes them attractive versus their physical appearance. So there's all these things that matter, and all those things can be better expressed, obviously through story than through
an image. And there's particularly something very intimate about audio stories. Some other thing I experienced was the podcast for me was an experiment. And I don't have 50 million downloads like you guys do, but we also have, downloads from all over the world. And I've been amazed at how important it is for people as just a part of sort of like getting through life and keeping them company and giving them some sense of connection. So it's a really powerful, is that what you guys' experience is?
Yeah, so we chose audio for our approach to erotica for women because of the psychological research there, like the women most visual, the men thing, but also it's more immersive. Most women use what we call like mental framing to get turned on. So like closing your eyes and imagining a scenario, that's more common for women versus like consuming a piece of content. And so that audio was good for all those reasons. And we could do like robust storytelling, it could be really immersive, and we could do it really, we could avoid questions of like body confidence is the biggest stressor in women's sex lives. And oh, so by removing like comparison in terms of visuals, it's a lot more effective.
You let your imagination run wild. Was there a time for you when you were, the idea was first percolating, that you were reading, I don't know, some novel or something like that, and you read a scene, you're like, wow, they nailed it. And
I do that all the time. Like I'm consuming romance. Uh-huh. Like, I mean, I've consumed romance my entire life. But I think like I've picked up a lot in the last couple of years because I think it's like, there's a lot of, I mean, things that I think we do better than like quote the genre as a whole, but that's not true of like any individual piece. And I think ultimately one of the challenges, in the space of erotica is not, that good erotica doesn't exist. Like it does. It's just the mm-hmm. discovery experience has been really bad. So what I mean by that is like, there is like subreddits of audio erotica, and there are some things on there that are like really good that I think are, you know, premium pieces. But to, the experience of going through a subreddit of audio erotica is like an extremely unpleasant experience. Like in terms of like the things you're seeing and the things that are there, like even just like the concept that erotica exists might be such a huge ick to you that like scrolling past it is already more negative. Women are more likely to have that experience. So women are much more likely, it's like women generally, but like women's desire, all desire, but particularly important for them to understand, mm-hmm. can be kind of mm-hmm. conceptualized as like a dual control yeah. model. So there is both like an accelerator, things that turn you on, and then they're like brakes. So like my feet are cold, or is the door locked, or I don't feel safe, or whatever. And so like when you're thinking about having sensitive breaks and what that means in the context of a search and discovery experience, like even going to Pornhub itself is too much of a break.
So you're a tech company. We're going to talk about the business sense, but you also are a story factory. How has your understanding of story changed and evolved over the time you've been doing this?
A good amount. So there's classic, obviously, conflict is a big part of good storytelling. You talk about that with John York. I listened to that podcast episode as well. There's conflict, there's disruption, there's resolution. We kind of jokingly say at Dipsy that like you don't basically want any conflict. Like you basically don't want it. Like you want maybe context. We have like a framework that we use internally called like a core desire framework. There's some like core thing that makes this like a desirable, makes this interesting, right? Like it's off limits. Like, okay, they're like your professor and your grad student or whatever. That's not really like conflict. Mm-hmm. So like, I don't want to have the people to like get into a fight. There's some like little context mm-hmm. that like creates the erotic moment, the desire, but mm-hmm. like we don't have, versus other storytelling, we're extremely light on conflict, no negative surprises. It just like it is the nothing sad, like nothing that kind of counteracts what we want it to be is like it's always happy endings. Like it's always something good. It may not be what you want to hear, like it's not interested in this or that, but it's never something bad. We in our early days, we had a lot more stories that would have things like bad things happen. Like we'll start with like, you know, running into your ex-boyfriend and being really sad. It's like skip the being sad part. Just like get to the hookup with your ex-boyfriend part. Like no one needs to start. We had like 3 minutes of like reminiscing on the horrible breakup. It's like cut that part. People can fucking imagine that if they want to, but like get to the part that actually is the payoff. Or we have this one like I story we constantly talk about internally that's like iconic, where it starts with an earthquake. It starts like there's like two people and they start, you hear like the sounds of an earthquake happening, and then like the whole city shut down and they like hook up in the apartment or whatever. But it's like it's actually the exact opposite. When you're coming to Dipsy, like 90% of the people listen to Dipsy, number one reason is for self-pleasure. And so Mm-hmm. If we're supporting that use case, like starting with the sound of like a natural disaster is pretty much like a slam on the brakes for almost any human being on earth, especially women. And so we've stripped out a lot of what people usually do to tell compelling stories, which is like conflict and have to leverage other things like character, or witty banter, or like jokes, other high intimacy things. We can't kind of, we just don't rely on the things that generally make stories like, quote, good.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So you've had to, have you seen the Kurt Vonnegut clip on storytelling?
I don't think so.
Oh, I got to mail it to you. Somebody mailed it to me the other day. It's freaking brilliant. Mm. It's basically, he has two axes of story, happy, sad, on the vertical axis, and beginning, end. And he basically takes, and he goes, this is all stories. And he basically shows, and why one of the key things for good stories is they have to, like he takes Cinderella through that, and he does all these different, but it's brilliant. And it's interesting, you know, that those things, it is like, you know, to more, you know, trading in a way is sort of like, what's the physics? What's the natural price that ought to exist? The same thing exists in stories, I found. And you have to obey those. So pause for a second on that. Turn to the business side of it.
Sure.
You and your partner have successfully created this business. Are you guys now cash flow positive?
Working on it.
Uh-huh. Got
close,
it.
Close. Closer every day. Closer every second, Paul.
How many years have you guys been at it?
Five.
It's unbelievably so. I'm 3 years into this thing. It is like, it's as big a deal. It's almost as big a deal for me as becoming a parent in terms of like these neurons turn on your brain that I never turned on before when I was working for somebody else. Now I'm working for myself. So talk about your journey. How's it going? What have you been learning? How are you financing this thing, et cetera, et cetera?
I mean, I guess before we raised any money, and that was kind of the plan, we were in San Francisco, we were going to raise venture capital. We wanted to prove out as much as we could. Like, I mean, before you devote your life to something, you want to like, you know, try to de-risk it a little bit in the cheapest possible way. And so the first couple stories, like we wrote ourselves, we got our friends to record, we like put them on a website and just saw how, I sent like emails, everyone I knew, a link to the website. I was like, hey, haven't heard from me in a while, but sorry, this company, let me know what you think. Like, here's five stories that we made, or six or something, audio stories. And here's a survey, let me know what you think. That was huge because it forced my partner and I think a big part of I starting a business, at least on my side, was also that like I could work with Gina. We could make something great together, greater than the sum of our parts, right? And if you hate your business partner, like it's just not worth it anyway, probably. And I love working with Gina. It's like one of the greatest gifts of Tipsy to me. So it helped us like push the idea into actualization. And we saw really quickly that it was very shareable, that people would talk about it. It was a big question we got from investors was like, could we really grow this thing? Would people talk about it? You know, in your book club experience, like women talk about stories they like.
Yeah.
And it's about, even if it's about sex, it doesn't really matter. Like it's about what's compelling to them, what things interesting. And helped us sort of like understand that there was some legs to this idea. We raised $5.5 million before we launched.
Mm-hmm. But just to talk about the piece, I'm slowing you down here. Mm. This is like a holy shit moment when you write these stories and you actually see the people are like, yeah, you've discovered something that didn't exist and that we want that. That must have been so exciting.
It was crazy. I mean, it seems like a dream to an extent, whereas like we recorded the first stories like in my kitchen in San Francisco, and we had to, now you're recording podcasts, you're like, know this stuff. We had to like unplug my fridge because the background sound, you get that like the ambi bed and the sound, right? So I was like learning sound engineering, like on the fucking fly to try to like record this stuff. And like twice I forgot to plug the fridge back in. It just like destroyed like a whole fridge. My roommates were luckily so kind to me and didn't like immediately kick me out of the house. But it was like that. It was like so scrappy and it was so exciting. And it was a huge like risk in a billion ways. In some ways in the very early years, it feels like less of a risk because I have to lose to an extent. It's like, it feels like it's more of a risk now and I've had the same experience. But like, it was also a huge shift in like identity for me. It was a huge shift in how I was perceived by every single person that I knew and every person that I met going forward. That's probably the part that was like the biggest reckoning for me in the first.
You mean
years.
The entrepreneur part or the erotica part?
The erotica part, like going from my work in finance to being like, and I have like 18 versions of the pitch that I give. It's like women's media startup all the way to like, you know, audio erotica is probably the most precise way to describe it. And just like having to go through that rep, you know, tell my parents, like tell my friends, like tell my ex colleagues. It's like, it's almost, and those people at least like have some other context for things that I do. I'm interested in. Like if you meet me at a wedding, I'm like the girl who works at Erotica. Like it's just like a totally different thing. You know what I'm saying? Like it just, I became a totally different person. And to go into a room with an investor and be pitching this, I mean, it was so different than anything I had ever done before.
Yeah.
And like in any business, you get a lot of no's when you're pitching. You get a lot of no's in your business, not just for investors, right? From all kinds of different ways the world tells you no. But like, you know, to say no because it was Vice, because it was like porn, because they didn't even want to be in the room with me. They felt like it was a risk. Like, I don't know. Like those kinds of things, it felt like very different than, you know, saying no because you like the size of the market, which, you know, that's also reasons that we heard that for sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I took you off track. So anyways, you guys wanted to, so you go out, you pitch this idea, you get $5.5 million of initial funding.
Which is great.
Uh-huh.
And it was a good proof point that we could.
That's a lot of dough.
Yeah. It was definitely a lot of money. It was what, and we needed it, honestly, because I think we learned a lot in the first year in market. And that was huge to have that basically cushion. I think having like an imagined idea and a lived idea is also really different.
Totally.
And, like capital is a really great way to get those reps in. It was not a business we could have bootstrapped, as it turns out.
Because why?
It takes money to make content.
Yes, it does.
To make audio content. Like, we have actors, we have studios, we have to post-produce it, at least the way that we've made it. And it's like, it's high. And part of the vision for the product was that it would feel like premium. Like it's basically, we have to talk about what it actually is, but it's kind of like you drop the microphone in the room, right? So it's like a full like movie with no visuals, right? So you hear like doors opening and footsteps and you hear like pants unzipping. Like it, so it's a full premium experience. That was part of like the vision we thought would be actually be effective to create this like mental framing for people. Yeah. It was meant to make. And the only way for us to really learn what would work was to put it out there and see if people listened to it and paid for it. And that just took a little while to figure out. And the reps on that are kind of relatively slow. Not relatively slow, but like weeks, you know, weeks that you're
totally,
you're waiting to sort of figure out from script to in the app to getting the feedback to, okay, we want episode two of this. We don't want episode two of that.
Mm-hmm.
So it ended up being like really, really huge and really exciting. So we spent, I mean, I don't know, this is like kind of like maybe too in the weeds, but like we're a subscription business. Like that was a big part. I think one of the two biggest questions that we had, existential questions that we had internally and from investors were, how are you going to grow the company?
Yep.
People talk about this. It's going to be like the back screen of your iPhone and like you don't even want to talk about it and it's like a secret. It's really hard to grow a product people don't want to talk about. Ended up that being like definitely not the case. And then two, would people pay for it? Like would women pay for this kind of content? Mm-hmm. That was a relatively unanswered question. So women pay for romance. It's not really the same thing. Mm-hmm. Like, and it's really hard to understand if women pay for like erotica or other. It's hard to like pull that question apart.
Yep.
And was there something that would be like icky feeling up putting on a credit card for this kind of a product, which again, ultimately ended up not being a problem. Other problems, never that one. People are very much willing to pay for premium content here. Women are at least. And so we want to put that out really early on. And so we, part of the reason why I took subscription from another perspective was we always want to be so like people want to pay for.
How'd you choose how much to charge for it?
I don't know. We fucking made it up.
Okay.
There's no way to choose that.
It's,
I mean,
tough.
We looked at comps. We like looked at Spotify, but I think a little cheaper than that, like whatever. I think ultimately, like there's no, I think this is like a stupid anecdote somebody told me last week, but it's really been sticking with me, which is like, you know, Martha Stewart had a pie stand or whatever, and she was like selling $5 pies and she couldn't sell any of them and maybe $25 and sold out in a day. It might not even be true, but like, I think it gets to like this context of like, of course, the like, if you make it more expensive, less people will pay. But there is like also some like tiers people have in their mind of like, this is like a premium product. It's not a premium product. And all we were trying to like promise people is this was different.
Mm-hmm.
And that also like a big thing that women really care about in this space, particularly, and audio is also a great way for us to promise this to people, is it's ethically created, that no one is harmed making this contact. Like, I mean, we're making content that is like, as I say, like, you know, erotic as, you know, as any erotic out there. But there's no like sex workers. And I think that makes a huge difference. And even for something like where you see visual sex scenes that are like on HBO or whatever, like And I would say that like we make much less explicit content that exists on like HBO in many dimensions, which people feel are more than happy to pay for, obviously, is like, are those actors even safe? Do they feel comfortable? There's always questions now about like how these content's being created.
And
like,
I've wondered about the exact same thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. They have like intimacy coordinators now on set. They're kind of trying to like improve the experience for people. If you want to deep dive on that, it's interesting. But like everything that we do is recorded separately, mixed together in professional studios. Like we could promise, that's a long tangent to say that like we could really promise an ethically created product. If people are like happy, if part of the promise of the product is that like it's ethically created, people are more than happy to pay for it. So we've played around with pricing a lot. I don't know. I'm not sure we have. There's not much of a science to it.
How do you market it?
Like, how do we grow? How do we advertise? Yeah. A lot of our growth is word of mouth, organic. We have a TikTok. You can see me on it. I'm out there making TikToks. We all talk about press a lot, but like, I don't know, the normal stuff like Instagram ads, podcast ads are huge for us. Mm-hmm. It's like an audio context, but I think ultimately like marketing, we think about the framing of it, like how we frame it in those contexts, but a lot of those places we can't even like in Instagram, for example, we can't even like use some of the terminology we might want to use to describe our product. But I think ultimately like marketing is fun. I think marketing is like one of the most interesting parts of my job. But like it only works if the product people want.
Mm-hmm.
Like it comes second to making a product that people actually want to pay for. Marketing only goes so far.
But you know, getting out the word is really important. It's hard. One thing Warren Buffett said about media, which I've thought about too, is he said people only have two eyeballs in 24 hours a day. And that's why media is hard. And so basically, if you're in the media business, you have to be stealing market share from somebody else. That's the game. And it's different than other, you know, being an oil company or something like
no,
that.
No, I think it's like the most, I think it's one of the most compelling parts of my job. And it's like a combination, like you said, of like super analytical science of like, where am I seeing the cheapest impressions and like the cheapest acquisition and of the people I acquire in this channel, do they like, you know, have higher, do they pay more for the product over time? Exactly. Like I'm so deep on it. Like I fucking love it. But ultimately I have to like make a cool ad, like, which is totally different kind of part of your brain.
Yes.
So yeah, I think it's awesome.
Yes. And have you found one particular advertising mechanism more effective than others? Is there one thing that you're like, that's the best of what we can, bag for the buck?
The thing that, this is like such a boring, obvious answer, but the thing that most consistently works is clips of our own content. Is like taking a compelling, hot moment from our content we make. Like we make what we think the best in the world, what we do, right? We invented the category and we've proven the demand for it. And I think we're doing the best job in the space of audio erotica for women. And if you get a really good clip there that's like spicy enough to get your attention, but like tame enough to be allowed on Instagram, like that'll convert people. There's lots of different versions of that. So we can frame that in terms of like, you know, two people talking or like one person guiding you, or there's like kind of flavors of that. But I think it's like leveraging the product itself to sort of speak for itself. I think besides that, that's kind of like the most consistent thing. And then I think in terms of how people talk about the product, one like fun little nugget is like we offer, I say like the bread and butter Dipsy content is these like short, sexy audio stories which are designed to turn you on. We also offer other audio content, sleep support and sort of like wellness education support, which makes a lot of sense. Like 9 p.m. to 1 a.m. is our highest usage time. People often use us in concurrent with their sleep app. So it's helpful for us to like make that content easy to make. But the way that we ask our users, like how they talk about us, they'll like mention the wellness and they'll say like, you know, it's women's wellness and health and empowering. Like I can't believe it didn't exist before. It's really hot, but they'll kind of talk about it. It's like umbrella. Like often they'll mention like the sexy auto stories and the health and wellness support and the sleep support, but they don't listen to the sexy stuff. Like there's this balance of how people, that like sometimes we have content, we think about every piece of content in the app, but the value it provides with making, right, costs money. Some of that is what I call like actual listening value, some of it's more like brand value. And those things sort of play a part in both our product experience and also like the marketing experience.
Describe what you think of the industry and how you make sense of it. I mean, in some sense, it always had this You know, I remember the first time, you know, as a kid, I saw pornographic photographs and it just being like mind altering that this industry even existed. And they're sort of at the cutting edge of what's been disruptive about the internet. And there's negative things and then you're trying to change that. So just take us through it.
I think maybe core to my principles, not my only principle, but is that like pleasure is good. Especially pleasure is not at the cost of someone. I mean, pleasure is not at the cost of someone's pain or whatever, obviously. But like the pursuit of pleasure itself is like a good thing to do. Like I generally a little bit of a hedonist, I guess. And so like, I don't think that like content that's made for erotic purposes like bad or a sinful or is a vice. That is not an opinion that is shared by all people and certainly not all LPs. And so like, I don't think there's anything wrong with seeking out content that gives you pleasure. I think like what that content is certainly matters. Make sure that content is ethically produced and it's and no one's getting hurt. And the creation of that content is really important and most people don't bother doing even that. And I also think that there is humans learn through stories. It's like how we teach kids morals, you know, like fables or whatever. And so as an adult, or as a kid, but as an adult, as we are, like when you're consuming stories, like you should think about what you're teaching yourself. You should think about like what that effect is on your own mind and how it's changing your perspectives on women, your desires. And there is a ton of research on like the negative effects of consuming specifically visual pornography, especially for men. And especially
because
I
haven't read the research. What it's because it does what?
Because it tends, it's like in like extreme amounts. And I don't think this is like, I think it's probably a great, obviously like a large reflection of like this, the kind of pornography that's readily available today versus like the intent of pornography generally. It tends to like basically like raise the bar of what it takes to get you aroused and reduce like sex drive in that reason. And also makes IRL sex less pleasurable. The extremes. And that the age at which people are exposed to like hardcore pornography is a lot lower than it used to be. So like the average age, I think that people now experience like exposure pornography is like 11. Yeah, it's like some pretty like absolutely terrifying articles you can read. I mean, New York Times did a big piece on this like 2 years ago. I'll send it to you after this. But like they like people have just like the, like part of the rise of this is like a part of the rise of audio, right? Everyone has like these high quality AirPods like in their pocket at all time, high quality headphones all the time. And it's like we've given like every single human on earth access to a device in the internet, and like a lot of the internet is pornography, and it's so human to look for it. And like, it's going to come up. Right. And so, and I just don't think that, I think that like what that effect is like, remains to be seen. And there's a lot of, I think, really positive impacts of having people have devices in their product on their sex lives. Like, we just did this survey, about like 10,000 people on the state of sex today. And it kind of confirmed a lot of what the other research says, which is like Gen Z is having less sex and want less sex and they have more anxiety about their than older people. And what's that about is probably like the million-dollar question. They tend to identify just more things as stressful, like fear of performance, fear of rejection, fear of trauma, body dysmorphia. Like, they just have like more concerns than older generations. But they also, I think, are wrestling with sex in a really different way than all generations are. I mean, especially for millennials. Like, I don't think I had the vocabulary to even describe my fears about sex in the way that younger people do. And my definition of sex is much more narrow, especially when I was like 22. I mean, it's probably a lot more. Hopefully I'm a little more wise now. But it's just very different. I also think the effect of the pandemic is hard to understand. Like, I don't know, a lot of stuff, a lot of headwinds. And, but yeah, I mean, it's definitely the case. It definitely seems to be the case that Gen Z is having less sex and wanting less sex than any other.
So having less sex with partners or wanting less sex? Because they could still be, you know, self-pleasure all the time, just not with other people, which is, it's kind of like Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone, if you've ever read that essay.
Yeah, well, I think that part of the thing that like makes me, it's hard to judge the research here, I would say, is that their definition of sex might be a little different than the way that like XYZ researchers define it. What I mean by that is like, we talk to our users a lot, right? And these are like, this isn't like a representative sample of the whole population, but it's people who are at least like willing to have conversations with us about their sex and pleasure and dating lives. And so we talk to our younger users. We have just as many Gen Z users as we do millennial users.
I'm getting Gen Z and millennial is?
Like if you're under the age of 25, like you're Gen Z right now.
Okay.
Roughly. I think it's like 1996 is the cutoff or something. I'm firmly millennial. But we're talking to this Gen Z user and she was 18 and she like, you know, was in college, lived in New York. And we're talking about her sex life, just kind of a broader survey about how she thinks about sex and masturbation and Dipsy, obviously. And she was like, well, I was having sex with this guy in Switzerland. And we were like, oh, like, when'd you go to Switzerland? Like my co-founder was like, I'm from Switzerland. Mm-hmm. And she's like, no, I've never been to Switzerland. I mean, like on the internet, like I was. And it's,
wow.
And so it's like, are they having less sex? It's kind of like an interesting question. Like maybe just the way that they're engaging with sex is really different. I think it's really hard to know. But like, certainly if you survey this person, like, have you had, you know, vaginal, whatever it is, have you wanted to define it? She probably would say no. But she's having like a sexual life. And she's in a way that probably is like, it might be something that like older age is less comfortable with, but like, it's certainly a lot physically safer for her. Like, you know, like there's a lot of things that are interesting about it that she might find really satisfying. She can explore things. You know what I mean? I don't know. So I think it's really hard to understand exactly what's happening. But most guys would point to the fact they're having less sex. But I do wonder if it's just like different. It's just different the way we're defining it.
Yeah, it strikes me hearing this. You know, it's. I've always thought that when there's a big change, and the internet would be an obvious one, it takes so long to actually understand in plain English what the implication of that change is.
Totally.
And I, you know, if I look back with, if you look 100 years, if you have like 100 years of distance, you can see it. Like now, you can see, oh, Industrial Revolution disrupting institutions. You know, World War I. You can make these connections, but it's only because it's way in the past.
Oh yeah.
And then when you're in it, and we're in it right now, understanding this stuff, like even the fact that what you're doing for your work and what I'm doing for my work right now, like basically these jobs couldn't even exist 20 years ago, and so it doesn't surprise me that A, it's difficult to understand, and B, intimacy broadly described is even more difficult to understand because it's so fucking complicated. It's often private. And who's collecting the data and how are they asking the questions? And that this woman was willing, like, imagine if she was being asked by me that same question. Like, is she going to give me the fucking truth? Unlikely. So for you, so it's wow.
Which is like, and I think especially for really like research on sex, dating, intimacy, like you think that for any kind of survey related research, people are going to lie.
Yeah.
I would like amp that up when it comes to sex. Like they're going to lie. There's like, which I think partially, so one of the books that I read that was like a big influence on me, sorry, Dipsy, it was called A Billion Wicked Thoughts.
A Billion Wicked Thoughts.
A Billion Wicked Thoughts. And it's kind of dated now, but it's interesting. And a big kind of like central thesis of the book was that people lie in interviews and surveys, and especially about sex. And so instead of looking at that research, although, you know, just that a little bit as well, let's see what people are actually consuming, like what they're
fork,
not what they say they want to eat, right? And so they, and there was at that time, like AOL had released a, which they now was like would never have happened, like basically anonymized search data for a bunch of people, which obviously you look at someone's search data, you figure out who they are. So like it was obviously a huge issue, but it was like released. And so yeah, you could see what people are typing in. And so a lot of like the foundational research that I'm citing here about like when men search this and women search that or whatever, it's not from those surveys, it's people like actually you're typing to the internet. It's like in 1999 or whatever now, but like there is something that's so true about and that information right now is like so locked down, like you can never get that information again.
Right.
But and that's part of what's interesting about my job too is like I don't get to see what Everett about America searches, but I definitely see people do on Dipsy and what they consume. Which is the best way for us to actually understand what
of course you really see it as surprising. Yeah. Is there a cultural element to this? One of the things that struck me when I lived in Russia for 3 years is how much more common infidelity was. And I was like, whoa. And then as more I traveled around the world, I really understood it's very, very specific what's normal, what's not normal in Is that an element in your guys' understanding or no?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're just like predominantly US. Okay. So there's not like major differences. I think the things that tend to be like the biggest, the step one differentiator on any of this kind of content is what genders of the people involved. Like that's just like that overrides almost any other preference. It's just like kind of like the point, turn one, you kind of like keep turning down smaller paths so you find what you want. And I think also because we're an audio company, like voice matters a lot, voice and accent.
Voice is huge. The podcast is called Things I Didn't Learn in School. You probably heard some of them. I always ask everybody this. There's a lot to choose from. You know, what are some of the biggest lessons you've learned through this process?
There's no standard to hold yourself to in life. Like so much of school is like, okay, I get top of this class, top of that class or whatever. I'm going to do extracurricular. I'm going to get to this college. And like nothing about life is like that, actually. And everyone's experiences of what is like best or prestigious is actually so small. Like I was in a small microcosm where being a Bridgewater was really, really cool. But like most people don't give a fuck about that at all. And like you can change that context. You can change your own yardstick there. So I don't know, that's a big one. I think that's kind of, I think probably hopefully anybody has learned over the course of their life up till now. Hopefully it's by like we're on your podcast. I've learned a lot of, I guess, like smaller lessons along the way about like the kind of person that I want to be and risk I want to take. And
say a little bit more about that.
There's a lot of things that I can regret about Dipsy, and you know, we ultimately like fail in many ways. We're definitely not Stripe, you know, like depending on what yardstick you want to compare us to. Like there are companies who start at the same time as us with the same amount of funding that did more successful. And there were tons of companies that started at the same time as us with the same amount of funding and don't exist anymore. And ultimately, like, I have to be proud that I tried. Like, and I think there are things about Dipsy, and there's like so much shit things about running a company, so many shit things about trying to like everything mattering more to you than any other job beforehand. And some of these are more painful and the stakes are so high, but it feels like good to be struggling. Struggling is something that you actually care about versus struggling something that like your fucking boss cares about.
Well, thank you, Faye Keegan. This was awesome. And I learned a ton, and I think our listeners will really enjoy it. Where should listeners find out about you?
We're available on the App Store and the Play Store. You can have to search us, Dipsy Stories. But yeah, you can search us, iOS, Android, available on all your mobile devices or on the web. Take a listen.
All right, talk to you later. Thanks for making time.
Of course. Bye.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. We're genuinely touched by all the support. If you want to see more of this type of content, sign up to my Substack on paulpodolsky.com and become a paid subscriber. That helps support the team. You could also submit a review to Apple Podcasts, which draws other listeners to this. If you have any questions, you can email me, paul@paulpodolsky.com, and follow me on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. Thanks so much.
Today's podcast was produced and edited by Dave Manahan.